It's message in the bottle time. Eric Mann from Bangor Wine and Cheese.
Eric Mann, Wine Merchant. Damn glad to meet you. You got all the good Erics on.
We do.
One authentic, one...
Oh, all completely. 100%.
I'm the inauthentic one. Yeah, folks. So, hey, I hope you're all enjoying this balmy spring weather. I made a mistake of actually wearing like 3 layers today. I am schwitzing all over. This is really bad.
Hope you're warm enough. It's a bad call.
Yeah, like I forget how to dress. You know, I switch from like cold weather to hot weather, and then I can't switch back until May.
It's Maine. It's hard to know, frankly.
Impossible. Which is why I brought a white wine today. I need something fresh. It's so hot. So yeah, folks, we're talking about the land down under and its neighbor New Zealand today because of how the calendar is falling this year. Next Tuesday will be my last live broadcast on the Rich Kimball Show until the new year.
Scared me.
He's agreed to take me back next year, so I'll be back. But next Tuesday will be my final one, and I always like to do a little special one about, and I'll have to sort of cram in my holiday and New Year's one next week. So today we're cramming in Australia and New Zealand. And so many things to talk about these two countries. We'll start with Australia, obviously. Well, we've all suffered through the yellowtail thing, right? So we kind of have an idea in general of what Australia is wine-wise, but let's kind of move past that and see what it is in depth a little bit. And not to say that it's not a lot of yellowtail. That's actually been a big problem. We'll get there. Australia is the world's fourth largest exporter. It is the world's fifth largest producer of wine. Only about 40% is consumed domestically, and wine is produced in every state with over 60 designated wine regions. However, the bulk of the important wine regions that we all know and love are, if you... I always have trouble, you know, saying what Australia looks like. Kind of looks like a kidney bean, right? Like sort of turned on its side.
Yeah.
And so in the southeast area of Australia is really where you see the bulk of the wine being made. And most of it is made all along the coast because as you get inland, it gets unbelievably dry and hot not good for any sort of agriculture whatsoever. In terms of laws, varietal labeled wines must contain at least 85% of that grape, which is stricter, as you'll recall, than the U.S., which only requires 75% of that grape, which is kind of interesting. The major varietals, obviously, we've all heard of Australian Shiraz. They're also big into the Bordelaise varietals, Cab, Merlot, and Petit Verdot, things like that for blending. Chardonnay, pretty big. For a long, long time, the white wine of choice was Riesling, and indeed, in places like the Clare Valley, it's grown absolutely exquisitely. Also, Semillon, which is a grape found in Bordeaux as well, although mostly in their sweet wine Sauterne. You see a lot of dry Semillon as well as sweet Semillon from Australia. And also, there's been a recent rise of Pinot Gris, which is actually... taking the place of a lot of the Riesling vineyards because Pinot Gris, being in the Pinot family, really likes cool weather, just like Riesling. And frankly, more of the world, the wine buying world, will buy Pinot Grigio or Pinot Gris than Riesling because of the stigma of sweetness, which is kind of silly. But, you know, we know that's silly because we know what we're talking about, folks, you know. But, you know, the great unwashed may not. Thank you for being washed with me. the bulk zones, and there's a lot of bulk zones, they tend to be in the warmer regions. The finer wine regions tend to have these places where, similar to all these other places we've been talking about, you get cooling currents coming up from Antarctica in this case, but, you know, as we've talked about, South America, North America, Europe, where you can get really, you know, extended ripening seasons is where you want to be growing your better grapes. Vine clippings first brought in the 1700s from the Cape of Good Hope by Dutch settlers. The initial plantings kind of failed, but let's be honest, if we learn anything in this little segment over the years, it's that people need to get their drink on. And so they were obstinate and basically figured it out. So by the 1820s, they were actually, there was enough of a wine industry that they were not only drinking it in country, but actually starting to export. Europeans liked them a lot when they started to get exported. The problem was they refused to believe they weren't actually French. So they did too good a job, and the French, being sort of the linchpin of the thing. They're like, all right, well, these are, you know, really good French varietals. They must be. And just FYI, and this is the case in a lot of, by the way, very, very famous wine regions. Up until recently, most of the wines were fortified or were sweet, you know. And the reason for that, let's be honest, is for longevity. You know, there wasn't climate control. There wasn't anything like that. So if you were shipping wine great distances, the only way to make sure it got there okay was to make sure that it had some sort of life expectancy and sweetness, fortification. Those are obviously ways to do that. And so really up until like the 1970s, that was pretty much the case. What ended up happening when we all sort of, you know, became aware of Australian wine, it was sort of a two-pronged effort and a two-pronged failure. You might call it success, but ultimately, when you're talking about the sort of mass production levels, it was failure. They started, by the way, Yellowtail introduced in 2001. Okay, it wasn't even around in the last century. But by 2004 and 2005, it and all those other Australian animal wines had been so popular that they had a glut problem and the government had to pay people to rip up their vines because there was just, they had no other plants. They just had grapes because they were pumping them out. The other prong of that two-pronged failure was that it wasn't just the cheap wines. There was a guy named Bobby Parker, Robert Parker, y'all know him, really, really, really likes big, 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 fat, ostentatious wines. Well, Australia was making a lot of big, 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 fat, ostentatious wines, and he was writing about them, as were others, not just his fault. And a lot of people spent a lot of money and put these wines down, and then they opened them up 10 years later, and they were dead. They didn't last at all. So people kind of fell out of favor, and it's really only now that you're starting to see a new wave of winemakers going in, finding these cool old vineyards, good places to grow things, are going biodynamic, are going, you know, natural, and really making wines that are lively, that are real. And you still see some real big, you know, Shiraz bombs from out of there, and people will always buy them. You just need to drink them young, we've learned, yeah? But there's a real renaissance happening in Australia, and you're only slowly starting to see the results of it. But boy, are the results exciting. So, you know, just give it another chance. If you've kind of written off Australia, I understand why. You know, we'll see what happens. It's a very, very interesting thing. They keep sort of having this problem. They really, really want to be a big wine power. And part of it actually leading as a sort of a segue into New Zealand, one of their big, big issues in Australia is that the number one selling white wine in Australia is New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc. So that kind of irritates them. Now let's talk about New Zealand. New Zealand is kind of a surprising entry onto the wine scene because it is one of the most isolated countries in the world. It is from Australia 3 hours and nothing else is closer. And yet they are exporting an enormous amount of wine. They're, 2/3 of their wine is sold internationally. And, I mean, obviously, we're drinking a New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc right now. A lot of you, you know, the Kim Crawfords, the Oyster Bays, the Cloudy Bays, all these bays, those are big. Now, what's kind of funny is there wasn't even, except for one planting that was planted in, 1873, there was no Sauvignon Blanc planted in New Zealand until 1973. None.
Wow.
One vineyard. Yeah. That's and today Marlborough Sauvignon Blanc is one of the biggest wines in the world. So what ended up happening? Early 70s, there was basically no serious viticulture happening, probably because they couldn't figure out a way to legitimately turn it into an enterprise that could reach beyond its borders, which is fair. But eventually winemaking caught on, even amongst like hobbyists, to the point where, similar to Australia, there was actually a huge glut of grapes after a huge crop in 2008, to the point where the amount of growers shrank to half of pre-2008 levels. There was just everybody had a lot of juice and nothing to do with it. And that's not a good thing. So basically what happened is, you know, having sort of culled the herd there, there's about 800 wineries scattered between the two islands. And for those of you who don't know, New Zealand is two islands, right? There's the island that is closer to the equator and the island that is farther from the equator. The region of Marlborough is at the north end of the southern island So that is, you know, sort of the focal point. But the next biggest growing area, Hawke's Bay, is on the southern end of the northern island. Other notable areas like the central Otago area is on the southern part of the southern island. What are they growing there? Well, they're obviously growing Sauvignon Blanc, but they're growing a lot of other really interesting things too, because it's actually a pretty diverse climate. What's really interesting, and I didn't even start to think about this, but we always talk about the moderating influence of water, right, and especially oceans. There's no vineyards in New Zealand that's more than 60 kilometers from the ocean because of the geography of the thing. It's just not that big. And so you have a lot of very favorable conditions for things like Pinot Noir is growing beautifully in Otago, the one I was just talking about, and other places. Certainly Chardonnay is growing nicely. Pinot Gris is growing nicely. On the Northern Ireland, they're having a considerable amount of success with Syrah in that very sort of pretty feminine French style. Vastly different from their Australian counterparts. They really shouldn't even be, you know, contained in the same breath. I'm shamed for even thinking of it. But it's quite remarkable just the difference and how, you know, again, from 1973 to now, they've become probably the biggest Sauvignon Blanc producer in the world in terms of notes and things like that. And they're certainly very, very popular. Well, I'm running out of time, so I want to talk about what's coming up at the store this week and next week. This week, Thursday, December 12th, we have Justin DeWalt from Chartrand Imports coming to show us some absolutely gorgeous biodynamic wines from the Loire Valley and from southern France. It'll be really cool. They're not sort of everyday wines, but they are very approachable and neat, and Justin really knows his stuff. So if you're particularly interested in you know, drinking more pure wines and the science behind it, he's the guy to ask. And then on the 19th, we will have our annual, you know, holiday tasting. We'll have our friends from Ager's Den Meadery in Pittsfield. We'll have our friend Carolyn pouring some wonderful holiday wines. And who knows, maybe some other treats, because that's how we do. And we'd love to see you. Both tastings are from 5 to 7 p.m. this Thursday, next Thursday, and are, of course, free and open to the public. And, of course, 21 plus to try any alcohol. And we look forward to seeing you, hopefully, for either or both of those. As I said, we're running out of time, so next week, just a little preview. We'll be doing my special Holy Land edition of of downtown, talking about, frankly, how, you know, some of the most unbelievable vineyard land in the world is under constant threat of war and sadness. But maybe, you know, if we realize it's a beautiful world, maybe we can all fix that. And then we'll talk about bubbles and things to do for New Year's. So we'll talk to you next week, and then we'll talk to you in 2020.
This is lovely, by the way.
It is. Haymaker Sauvignon Blanc from Marlboro.
Excellent. Thank you, Eric. Eric Mann, Bangor Wine and Cheese Company. Message in the Bottle every Tuesday. Check out all of Eric's segments. They're all archived on the website. Click on the Message in the Bottle link, downtownwithrichkimble.com.